Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, best-selling author, academic, psychotherapist, speaker, advocate, and all-round deadly human, Katrina O'Sullivan. As I said before the news, there's just so much to talk to Katrina about. I've decided to dedicate the entire show to her. A show with a bit of a difference. It's the first time a guest has been given the whole show, but it's a testament to Katrina, her story, her energy, her expertise. So much of what she talks about is entrenched in what I believe is the foundation of true health and wellness. The impact trauma can have on your life, the power of support and talk therapy, the importance of connection, the access to opportunity. All of this comes before green juices and yoga pants, though they are indeed fine endeavours. In her latest book, Hungry, Katrina explores the relationship she has with hunger and her body. I fundamentally believe that a healthy relationship with food and our bodies is one of the cornerstones of health and well-being, but it's not easy to achieve. Influenced by a myriad of things from our upbringing, our experience to society at large, our relationship with our bodies can be fraught with insecurity, misogyny, and lead to a disconnect. Katrina looks at this, as well as the role poverty played in the literal sense of hunger in her life, but later a hunger to be liked, putting the needs of others before her own and the hunger to succeed and prove ourselves. I felt all of that was worthy of a full show. I'd love to hear your thoughts on today's conversation. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Before we dive in, I do need a slight warning as this conversation is going out early on Sunday morning. There are some discussions of an adult nature to come and some of Katrina's experience may be triggering. But Katrina, you are very welcome.
So glad to be here.
I got to meet you first at another book launch. It was actually Dr. Clodagh Campbell.
Yeah.
And we threw out to the audience for questions and you asked a question.
Yeah.
And I had a mad experience because I was reading Poor at the time. So your voice had been in my head.
Yeah.
And yet there was your actual voice. And I said to you that night, I'd love to interview you.
Yes.
And you said, well, I'm writing another book. So maybe about that.
Yeah.
So here we are.
I know.
And you gave me a little spoiler alert as to what the book would be about, Hungry. It's here now. And I said to you then, as I say to you now, it's such an important topic and,
yeah.
and one I feel very passionately about, our relationship with our bodies and hunger and asking for what we want.
Yeah. I remember
so
the conversation,
more.
Actually, because when you were on the stage, I asked a question, you were like, oh my God, I'm reading your book. But then when we were having coffee or tea, I said, I love your top. And you were like, oh, I got it from here. And you sent me a link, which is the most amazing things about women. But then we got talking about bodies and I was telling you about the new book and about, yeah. And you were, I know you're passionate about, you know, women feeling empowered and loving their bodies. So it makes perfect sense to talk about this.
And how does it feel to have it out in the world now? You now have two books concurrently in the top 10.
Yeah.
It was it different this time? Because obviously when you wrote Poor, you knew you had something to say. You knew you wanted to put it out there, but you were unknown. It kind of went out to the ether and it was like, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
How different was it to bring this one out?
I think I didn't decide to write a second book, but I am a writer and I love to write. And I don't think they're memoir as well. So I've had this conversation. I actually think they're kind of social documents. They're reflections. They're using my story to reflect on important issues that happen in society. And as an academic, I write a lot. But this particular book, I suppose the feeling, it came from a series of interactions on social media, doing some radio, and just an observation that we are not allowed to like ourselves as women. And some women are taught lessons about their body because of where they come from in the world and the type of trauma they had. And so this idea kind of just kept coming to me and I was like, okay, I think I'm going to write a second book. And obviously, like, Poor has a long shadow because it's so successful. And lots of people jokingly would say, oh, the dreaded second album. And I would say, well, Adele's second album was better than her first album. I think the thing is, you have to write without restriction. You have to not think about sometimes the reader in the sense and that how they're going to compare books. I just had to write the best story that I could possibly write and the best book I could possibly write and hope that people liked it. And they have so far, which has been fantastic. So, but I do think my publisher had more awareness of the success of Poor than I did. Or I kind of sense that sometimes in conversations, which could be a little bit intimidating and a bit terrifying. But in the end, I just like to write. And so I just kept focusing on that. Just keep writing and do the best you can. And then if someone likes it, they do. And if they don't, sure, what can you do? Like,
yeah,
I've done my best at the end of the day. So yeah, it's been an amazing experience though. And very different to Poor in terms of the response to the book and also the process of writing it, because my confidence was much higher this time, I suppose, than the first time.
Yeah. And you do take all readers on such a journey. Like, you took me on a deeper understanding, obviously with Poor, of poverty and, you know, excellence being everywhere but opportunity not, and really reframed so much of what people may think. We all have unconscious bias, whether we like it or not. And likewise with Hungry, as you say, it's something I'm very passionate about, but you brought me on a deeper level with it, because at the start you sort of tell your story from childhood, again, with a different lens in a way. And I thought perhaps at the beginning that was for people who maybe hadn't read Poor.
Mm.
But actually, it tells you that our relationship with our bodies is a very complex one that goes right back to our experiences in childhood. It goes way beyond just, you know, wanting to fit a smaller size jean.
Yeah, so none of us are born with the desire to be smaller. I actually think none of, you know, the awareness of our bodies generally, if the world left us alone, is quite positive. Like, and I talk about that in the start of the book, about the general memory of just feeling like my body was deadly. Like, I just thought I was as good as everybody else. I didn't even know I was a girl. Even the gendering of bodies and the conversations that we have about, like, gender expression, like, I just thought I was just a person, and I was just a little kid, and my body was deadly, and I could run and I could jump and I could fight and I could play football, and I was as good as the lads and the girls. So I talk about that. But then, yeah, the way the world communicates our value and our physical being is one of the things that I bring the reader through. Now, in my case, it's very extreme, the things that I observed and the messages that I got about my body from my family, from my mom, my dad's relationship with women. But all of them, I think, relate to us in some way. They may not be as extreme as they were for me, but we are all, little girls are taught that they're pretty beings from a very small age. We talk to them with softer tones. We use different descriptive words for them. We value them around how pretty they are, how they look. So I use my story in some ways to try to highlight what influences our body and what we think about our body. And so, yeah, that is the, I don't write that part for the reader who didn't read Poor. I write this book completely separate as Poor, for a person who's never known my story to be able to say, oh, this is how we learn about our bodies. This is how we feel valuable. And in my case, how my dad related to women and girls and me as a girl influenced what I thought my value was, and how my mum related to her body. That was really important as well, because as mothers or women, we look at how other women relate to their bodies and we internalize that. And it's not about hiding not liking your body from a little girl. It's really important that we like our bodies for little girls to like their bodies. So, yeah, it is a story of bringing you through my childhood and saying these are the things that made me feel good and bad about my physical being.
Yeah. And I mean, you talk about not even knowing you were a girl.
No.
You were just like one of the kids.
I was just one of the kids.
And I just had a bit of an aha moment there. Like, you were really good at football.
Yeah.
And isn't your eldest son really good at football? And he probably got that from you. You could be a professional footballer. Well, I mean, I'm glad you're a writer.
Yes. I love that. So I did play football, and I was, all my family, my brothers were great at football, and there was no difference between me and the lads. Physicality is the only difference sometimes. And I love saying this. So my son, John, gets his skills from me. His dad was terrible at football, by the way, and he had no capability to move at all. So John's professional capabilities not only came from me and my side of my family, I believe, but his determination and his capacity to actually continue in a profession that's really difficult to see that succeed in, that also came from me and my mindset and our home and the way I brought him up. Like when I met my husband, Dave, John was 9 or 10. And I said to Dave, John's going to be a professional footballer. And Dave said, it's the only time he thought, I'm not actually going to be with this girl because she's crazy, because it's so rare. But like we had this mindset in my house as you can be anything. And I said to John, if that's what you want to be, then here's what we have to do. We have to work really hard. You have to train really hard. And he had the physical capability. And I believe that came from me. And
yes.
Yes.
I'm giving you that.
Exactly.
The career you couldn't have in football because society wasn't quite ready. Yeah. Thankfully funneled you in this way.
Yeah. I think as well, on a more serious note, the conversation about our gender identity is very big now. And it's really important to say that girls and boys are socialized into their gender identity. Like your sex and your gender are different things. Like, so girls and boys are socialized into like their representation of their physical self. Like, obviously there's differences between our strength. So capacity for strength does differ between males and females. But as a little girl, like I didn't know I was a little girl at all until the world taught me what that meant. And what that meant was beautiful, smaller, attractive to men, demure. I'm not demure, by the way, which has always been a problem, that I'm mouthy and it doesn't fit with what you're taught a girl should be.
A good girl.
A good girl. And so like how we learn about our expression and what the right expression of being a girl is, we learn that from society and we learn it in our families. And I think it's really important that we think about that in the world that we're in today, where we're trying to force gender norms on people. And in my case, I just thought I was just a deadly little kid.
Yeah.
Didn't even know I was a girl until the world told me, you're a girl. And girls do this. And girls don't do that.
And it really fascinates me. And I have a boy and a girl.
Yeah.
And, you know, watching them move through the world, I mean, I feel a real responsibility to both of them. But in particular, my daughter, that she doesn't have to be a good girl. And she's not rated by that alone. But society has a way to go, and it's a conversation we certainly need to have more and more. I want to ask you a little bit about what you said there about the mindset that you gave your son and the importance of having someone to believe in you. And do you think that that really plays into how we help our next generation navigate all of this? Yes, you're right, we're having lots more conversations, but we're still essentially pushing for the same thing over and over again. And is it important that we inspire them, particularly when you hear things, it's so much more than sport, but that so many girls, as they hit into their teens, remove themselves from sports they love and enjoy?
Yeah, I think inspiring is important, but also, inspiration, having inspiration. Like the most important thing is love. Like that's the thing that's so important for all of us. Like in my book, I talk about poverty and how that affected my relationship with my body and my ability to achieve things. And I use these terms, rich, poor and poor, poor, to try to like differentiate between working class people and underclass people, which is what I would have been. And a lot of people, when I talk about that, they'll say, well, what about the poor rich? And the truth is, whenever anybody says that to me, is what they're actually saying is the thing that is missing in families that are disadvantaged, like mine and like others, is love. Is having an adult, a human being, to believe in them, to be consistent with them, to tell them that they can be and do whatever they want to be, and then help them to achieve that. And so I think being like mindset, when we talk about mindset and, you know, having a great mindset or having that instilled in someone, it's really important. But fundamentally, if we have one person or two or five or 50 in our lives who love us, and provide the opportunities, equal opportunities, and inspire us and allow us to explore things and fail at them and then try other things, then that is the recipe for success. And I think success is finding the things that you're passionate about, that you're good at, and being able to do them. And unfortunately, we live in a world where everybody doesn't get that equally. They don't get the opportunity to do that equally. Girls get it differently, physically, emotionally, societally, poor people get it differently as well. So I don't know what I'm saying here. Basically what I'm saying is love is the key.
Yeah.
and having stability and somebody there. Love means having somebody there who can believe in you, trust you, fight for you and show you what you can be and support you when you fail at that thing and find another thing. So I think they're the most important things, not necessarily inspiration. It's just love. And with my son, when I talk about mindset in my house, when I began to heal and got better, like my most important focus was how am I going to create that environment for him to know that he can be anything he wants to be, that he can fail at anything and I'm always going to be here, and that he feels like he's the most amazing person in my life. I'm going to cry saying that. Like, he's on holiday now. I don't really talk about him as much as this. And he's 32 now. He's married. He's a lovely kid and they're having another baby. But they sent a little photo in the WhatsApp group of the little family. And I was like, John, you know you look beautiful, don't you? But like, to me, you know, it's so important that we have that adult, that human being in our life forever who loves us and provides all that care and that inspiring opportunity for us. And I'm glad I'm that for him. But I didn't have that, you know, as a young person. And that's what caused a lot of the hassles that I had in my own life.
Yeah, and I don't think we, and I put myself in this bracket, really understand, and that's why you like pull us and go, listen,
yeah,
understand what privilege really means, understand what poor really means, understand what hunger really means. Mm. And we love a rags to riches story, don't we?
So
we love, and look, I do love you, but we love you. We're like, and look, and she came through and she's a professor now.
Yeah.
But it's not the same for everybody.
No.
That's not a reality for everybody.
No. And look, my book is so successful, poor particularly, is because it's so rare. Like, it shouldn't be rare. What I've done shouldn't be rare. You should be able to become socially mobile and discover your talents and go off and succeed in them. But the truth is, if you're born into poverty and disadvantage and trauma like I was, that is your future. It reproduces itself in the same way that privilege does. I've learned through education. So, yeah, we love a rags to riches tale, but my tale isn't rags to riches. My tale is rags to living a much better life with the consequences of the things that I've been through. And so my foundations are fractured and will always be fractured. I'll always be at risk of mental health difficulties. There's a cliff edge that exists in my life that doesn't exist in somebody else's life who just made it this way. And so it's not rags to riches. It's more like how did she get here and what do we do to build the structure around her because of what she'd been through in order for her to demonstrate how brilliant she is to the world. And I always worry that my story is going to be used to hurt other people like me. Well, she did it. Why didn't she do it? And the truth is, it's really, really hard. Gary Gannon, the TD, years ago, I was at a talk that he did, and he said, navigating higher education and privileged world when you don't come from it is like learning the dark arts. And it was brilliant because that's exactly what it's like. Escaping your destiny is so hard. And in some ways, it was just accidental. And in other ways, somebody else picked me up and dragged me forward a few steps, and I went back a few steps. I don't want to be used to hurt other women who don't make it. I want my story to be used as what we can do to help other people. And poor is that in terms of the structure in education and the hope. And hungry is that in terms of access to mental health supports and therapy and how them things can heal a damaged relationship with your body.
Yeah, and we don't have enough of that access. Now, it's not the norm. That's one of my biggest wishes that I put out there. I think we should have access to mental health supports in every secondary school. So it's the norm. You have big feelings, you go talk about it, you need support, you seek it.
Now we do have, so I'm on the DESH panel, the DESH advisory panel for the state, and the new DESH Plus plan, which has been introduced recently through the government. I have to give them kudos because I give them a lot of criticism. They are in now, there is going to be mental health and an actually appointed staff member in DESH Plus schools, primary schools. And what they are, they're schools that have been identified as being like entrenched long-term intergenerational disadvantage trauma in the schools. So there has been some move towards having them in schools. The reason I wrote poor, the only reason I said yes, is I didn't get here because of education. Education wasn't the first step for me. mental health supports were the first step for me. So I asked for help at a local community centre, and this guy, Joe, said to me, "You need therapy." And I went, "No way." And he said, "You do." And within a week of asking for help, I was in front of the first therapist I ever saw. That was the start, Claire. It wasn't Trinity College. That was the PhD. It was having access. And I think the thing that we don't talk about enough is women and mothers are the least likely to get access to mental health supports, especially if they're poor. And actually, the investment in that has the biggest savings for the state and the world. So when you empower a mother, when you help her psychologically and educationally, employment-wise, it changes the future of our whole family, which reduces the cost to society. And we don't talk about that. I'm the same as you. Like, if it was today and I'd have gone over to that centre, first the centre's gone, it's not funded anymore, and I would have been on a waiting list for at least 6 to 8 months to get therapy from that same place, and I probably wouldn't have gone back, because most of us only ask once or twice and then we continue with the life and you continue getting less and less. My brother, I don't talk about him a lot, but he grew up in the same house as me. He went to prison for the first time when he was 16. In 1999, when I asked for help, I got it. He was in a serious situation psychologically at the same time. He asked for help at that time and never got it. His life has been recidivism, prisons, worse crimes. Mine has gone this socially mobile person with the same intellectually, emotionally, all the experiences, but I got help and he didn't. So I'm very, very much in favour of mental health supports for people who ask for them. And obviously then teaching our children how to be literate in terms of their mental well-being.
Yeah, 100%. It would make the biggest difference, as you say, to people's foundation and going forward. We're going to have to take a quick break.
Yeah.
And when we come back, we'll get into the relationship we have with our body, because, as I said, it's a very important one. You're listening to Alive and Kicking here on News Talk, and I'm joined in studio by Katrina O'Sullivan. And among many other things, we're talking about her new brilliant book called Hungry.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk. Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking, where I'm joined in studio by Katrina O'Sullivan, Dr. Katrina O'Sullivan. And we're talking about, among other things, her book, Hungry. And I said before the break, a lot of the times we don't understand privilege, we don't understand poverty, and I don't think we understand hunger. And you spoke out recently, and it kind of shook me. And I was really appreciative of the recalibration that you gave me around schools, programs, and food.
Yeah.
And yes, nutrition is important, but you were like, hang on a second here. It's a very privileged thing to say. Some kids just need to eat. And I think we all need to hear that. So thank you for that.
Yeah, that has probably been one of the most controversial things that I said in the last few years, because I've said a few things. The most reactive or biggest response I've had is to my column, which I said, just feed the kids. Stop pontificating about the quality of food, feed them and then make it better. But because obviously I was witnessing so much conversation about the school meals programs, and a lot of people who have opinions about the school meals program have never sat in a class and known what it's like to be absolutely starving. And in my case, I don't know if people really know what it's like to try and learn quadratic equations or the history of Ireland or rocks or whatever. While your belly is the loudest noise, your empty stomach is the loudest noise you can hear. Not only does it make you unable to listen, but emotionally it makes you extremely reactive or extremely unregulated. Like, we've all heard the term hangry in adulthood, but when you're under the age of 14 and you haven't even got the ability to regulate your emotions properly yet, because you haven't learned how, hunger like is the beginning of the end of your ability to regulate yourself emotionally. And the whole conversation about ultra processed foods, how the chicken nuggets, the chicken goujons are not pure chicken, like, really got my goat, Claire. Because two reasons is, first, feed the kids. And if you want to fix the food, then fix the food. I want healthy food for everybody. But there's another thing that goes underneath this, and that is about food education. Like, I didn't grow up with what you might have grown up with. Like, when I went to Trinity, I remember witnessing people bringing out like little lunchboxes with couscous and raisins in it and thinking, what the heck is that? Like, I grew up on a diet of egg and chips at the end of the day. Like, your palate is affected by how you grow up and what type of foods that you're exposed to. I was taught that chicken nuggets from Iceland is a healthy meal. I didn't know that until I actually got educated that that's not actually what a healthy meal is, until I learned about the food pyramid. So there's also this other layer of this conversation around, don't expect people who are underserved in terms of food education to eat your privileged food without actually providing it then to them from the beginning of their lives at the end of the day. So there's another conversation I think is really important around food privilege and food education. But for me, I'm like, yes, I want healthy food for every child. But like, if that's not an offer, just give them whatever's there and then fix it, rather than pontificating about it and moralizing about it, because I couldn't learn at all. And I, you know, I used to get stood up and berated by one of my teachers because I literally could not concentrate in our class. I still have like tears in the corner of my eyes when I think about standing underneath this teacher who used to bawl at me because I didn't pay attention. But I was so hungry. And when it got close to 12:30 in the day, when the lunch was fair, we got free school meals. The closer it got to 12:30, so like sometimes the free lunch was the only meal I had in a day. So if you imagine, I'd go from 12:30 till the next day at 12:30 with nothing. By 12:00, I wasn't paying any attention. I was like Pavlov's dog, salivating because I could hear the canteen opening 5 minutes away from me, and this teacher would berate me. And I'm like, let's not make this an issue. Like, let's just feed the kids and then fix it, rather than doing all of the other things.
Yeah, well, I just thought it was a very important voice in the conversation. Yeah. And thank you. I want to talk also then about women and their bodies. You brought me on such a memory lane journey to Weight Watchers. Oh. And the wheel.
Mm.
The wheel.
The wheel.
And knowing the calorie content of everything. But you touched on it earlier, and I think it starts when we start to become objectified,
yeah,
that our power is within our bodies.
Mm.
And you speak, you know, about women in your life who have a love-hate relationship with their bodies, which I think most women do. We see it can have the power to attract, and yet we diss it,
yeah,
when we're on our own with it.
Yeah.
So that's a lot for us to be taking on. No wonder we get skewed.
Oh my God. Like, I read a research paper that said 30% of our mental power is spent considering how much we don't like our bodies, or trying to shrink our bodies or control our bodies. Like, imagine if we had that 30%, but we're already amazing as women with what we do and what we achieve. Imagine if we had that back. But yeah, this is where the whole idea from Hungry started, was being in one moment, like being really aware of how amazing my body is, how beautiful my hair is, like looking in the mirror, really liking myself. And then thinking about my babies and how, you know, and how I'm surviving trauma and all these things that have happened to me. And then in the same breath going, but you need to be smaller, and the size of your belly and your boobs are too big, and look at the lines on your forehead. Like, these two competing feelings all in the same moment. And most women, I don't know any woman who is completely likes herself, or is not trying to control where she is at. So stay there. So stay young, stay small, stay in the beauty that she's in right now. I don't know any woman who isn't, well, I know a couple who are a bit like, I don't care, but I think they're at the other extreme where they're like not caring at all about themselves. So their self-esteem is at the length. But I don't know any woman who doesn't have some level of issue with their body, their face, they're trying to control themselves. And yeah, like, it's a really important conversation about like attraction, like, and our worth in terms of the male gaze or the female gaze, but the male gaze particularly. It's like, it's not okay to want to be wanted by men, but we want to be wanted by men, and we want to be a certain shape or size to please other women and ourselves. And there's a whole, and underneath all of it, none of it is about health, really. Like, none of it is about health. A lot of it is about attractiveness and beauty, and so it's really complicated. And I talk about watching my mom. That was the first time that I witnessed. So my mom would dance, and she knew she was sexy, and I'd look at her, and I knew she knew that she had power over my dad. I remember witnessing them. You know, that was obviously when they were in good form with each other. She'd be dancing to Fleetwood Mac, and I'd look at her, and she liked herself. And then the next breath, I'd see her in front of the mirror, like pulling at the rolls of fat on her belly. She had five kids. She had a big overhang. Oh, I hate this. It's disgusting. And I was like, oh my God, it's really complicated to witness women feeling that way. And I think that's what little girls see an awful lot, is women liking themselves but hating themselves all in the same breath. And I think it's problematic.
And we have thankfully started to talk more, although we have a long way to go, about diet culture, about body positivity or body neutrality, I prefer. And we have started to talk differently. I mean, even you walk up through Grafton Street or whatever and you see bigger mannequins in windows. Yeah. I mean, that's a more of a positive step than when I was growing up. But something that we don't talk a lot about, which you do, is our inability to ask for what we need with our bodies or to think that we deserve pleasure. Like that was, I don't know if you like the word brave, but that is brave because that's very personal. That's not something we kind of close the bedroom door and what happens in there happens in there. But you bring us on that journey, and so many of us women will be able to identify with that, that loving our body, that loving the male gaze. But then when you get to that moment, just thinking it's all about them.
We're saying that moment. We're talking about orgasms here. Let's just name it. I hope we can say that this time of the day.
But or look, lack thereof.
So, yeah, like the quiet messages of the media and the world is that, like, we're to be sexy for men, but their needs are more important than our needs. I don't know when I learned or how I learned it, but there was this idea that once a man was excited, in inverted commas, like that had to come to an end. Whereas with us, like we could just push that to one side, like that, like women don't need pleasure, and that message is everywhere. But it's so subtle in some way. It's not direct. It's not subtle. And then women who do desire sex, or they're sluts, or they're wanton women, like they're bad women at the end of the day, and they're vilified. So yeah, for me in my journey, and like this book does talk about sexual trauma as well. So like on top of, so, and it's important that I name that, because this, whether I had trauma or not, I would have learned that my pleasure was less important than a man's pleasure from the world. However, with the experiences that I had in terms of having my body taken by somebody without my consent, what happened to me was the want for pleasure went awry and was askew. So it's very hard for me to even feel pleasure in my own body. And then, so I got into situations, so hungry is a play on words. It's about hunger for connection, hunger for to be smaller, hunger for achievement. So I got into lots of destructive relationships that actually reaffirmed to me, I didn't do that consciously, reaffirmed my lack of value, the lack of the connection I had with my body, until I went to therapy. And I was in this therapy and I was talking about all these bad relationships, shit sex, never enjoying it. And I just had this epiphany. I was like, I'm never having sex again without enjoying it. I'm never going to do it without having an orgasm again. And like my therapist, I didn't know at the time, was a nun, which was, I found out like a year in, and she was like, good for you. And then I met Dave, and I literally did two things. I stopped having relationships for a full year. I literally said, I'm not going to be with anyone physically for a year while I'm on this healing journey. And the next time I'm with someone, I'm never going to put his pleasure above mine. And then I met Dave. And so, yeah, I talk about that. And Dave's absolutely fine with me talking about it, because he'd never had a woman talk to him about his body either, about her body. He'd never had a woman say, this is how you do it, or this is how you don't do it, or I'm not enjoying that. Like, he also grew up in a world that said his pleasure was more important than the woman's pleasure. So the two of us met, and we decided together, like, okay, we're going to actually be open and talk. Now, if you've got a marriage or a relationship that's already like that, amazing. But the amount of women I know that have never spoken about what they want sexually, or don't even know what they want sexually, is a lot. And I think it's really important that we own our own bodies and the joy. like orgasms actually increase your health. They help your immune system, whether you're having them with another person or on your own. Like, it's really important to actually enjoy your body. And we are one of the only species that has an actual space for us to have full enjoyment of the sexual act. So why not? Why not do it?
And it goes back to that good girl mentality where we just shrink to fit and we don't speak up, definitely not too loud.
No.
Whereas everything in the book talks about asking for what you need. But until we know ourselves and know how we feel and know why we are the way we are, and I say that with self-compassion and with compassion for other people and empathy,
yes,
and it may be a long and tricky road and need support.
Yes.
But when you get to that point, let's not be afraid to ask for what we need.
No, like, absolutely. And the thing about it is most people want to give you what you want and need. Like, and I know that I'm respected because I am able to say that. But it did take me a long time to get to that point. And sometimes I didn't actually know. So, like, it depends where you are in your own journey of health and well-being and empowerment. I think if we're talking about sex particularly, I think the most important thing that you can do firstly in that relationship is begin to like your body. Like, I had a great friend, Audrey, who she used to say to me, use lotion every day on your body. Katrina, every part of you. She'd say, lotion yourself, like every, and I would like, like, because not like even to touch my own body. And so she'd be like, you know, embrace your own body. So it depends where you are. But in terms of that, I suppose that sexual empowerment piece, the first piece is actually trying to like your own body and know your own body and know what you find pleasing and what you don't. And that can be a wonderful journey that you go on your own or with another person. And then the next thing is obviously being able to say it in a safe way. A lot of people who've contacted me, women in particular, say, I actually can't talk to my husband like that. And that is something that's, I think, in a marriage is important, is conversation. And so I would say to women, well, maybe it's time to start chatting a bit more and talking. But we are taught as women to be demure or we're taught that we should run the house. We should be in charge of the kids and everything else. But like that we shouldn't be demanding at the same breath. We shouldn't be demanding. And this isn't being demanding. It's just being equal. It's just actually expecting what a man expects in the bedroom or what, you know, what your partner expects. And for me, it's been a wonderful experience and a really healing one.
We need to take another ad break.
Yeah.
And when we come back, we have some books to give away. And we'll get to that, but we'll take a break. You're listening to Alive and Kicking here on News Talk with Claire McKenna, and I'm joined in studio by Katrina O'Sullivan.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk. Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking, where I'm joined in studio by Katrina O'Sullivan. And Katrina, I cheekily went to London to see you talk, interviewed by Annie Mack. It was fab.
Amazing.
I had a lovely time with my friend Jenny, and I get sent press copies of books all the time.
Yep.
And I brought two of those with me and got you to sign them. And I thought that was a bit cheeky.
She didn't buy a book.
So I decided I would purchase five books, which I did this morning.
Amazing.
And I'm going to give them away. In the true spirit of poor, there may be people listening who want to read this book, be they male or female or however you identify. This isn't just a book for women.
No.
I think people should know this stuff. And I'm going to give them away. So I would like people to email to aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. And look, we all can be hungry in different ways and hungry for this information and hungry for change. But let's give these five books away to people who are not in a position to walk into one of the bookshops and buy it. That's all I'll say. You don't need to explain yourself. Just say book, please, and send it. And I will post it to you if you send me your name and address.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Claire.
And I know I do. I try to be fair and good and conscious.
Yeah.
And I think it is important. And I do think when you give back in that way, you gain from it. Let's all be connected in this world.
I am writing a third book. I've actually written a kid's book, but I'm writing a third book, and it's about how to like yourself. That's what the title is, the running title is for now. It's just the things that I do to actually like myself. And one of the most important things that I do is I give to other people. Like I think it's the most underrated self-help tool is giving to other people. Like, it is like we live in a world that tells us to be stronger, improve your mindset, work harder, do a plan. No, if you want to feel better, do something nice for somebody else. If you want to consistently feel better about your life, and I don't mean that in a cynical way, but literally giving a fiver to a poor person at the lights, irrespective of what they're going to use it for, will actually help you a lot more than buying a planner
and supplements
and like planning what you're going to do for the rest of your life at the end of the day. Like, we live in it's quite cynical, and we've commodified humanity in some ways. Like, we've actually suggested that you have to do this, this, this to be a successful person. I loved your book, Claire. It sits actually in my bathroom because I think it's a great spot for someone to actually pick it up and just get some insight. I've got two copies, but I like the fact that it's actually just realistic advice about how to be healthy. Would you be well? And what to do, little steps that you can do. But for me, helping another person is fundamentally the key to actually changing how you feel about yourself. And we all think we have to be at a certain space. Like, I run a mentoring program through the STEM Passport for Inclusion. It's my project that I run in Maynooth. And people email me, I actually couldn't be a mentor because, like, I'm not that successful. And I'm like, yes, you could. Like, all of us have the capacity to help another person. You don't have to be Katrina O'Sullivan, a big writer or a big successful...
Have your own brand.
No,
I know,
you
you're
can
so right.
Just be kind to somebody. And like, a lot of my friends say, "Do you like, how do you deal with the people sending you messages or emails?" I'm like, I'm kind to people and I say to them, "I hear you, here's a hug, blah, blah, blah." That helps me more than anything else that I do. More than anything else that I do is the giving back to people. So if you want to feel better about yourself, think about how you can be kind to other people. And once you start getting into that mindset, it actually appeases, like, I don't care about my body. I don't care about the lines on my face. I don't care about the things I failed at. I actually just get this innate feeling of like, I'm actually good and life is good. And it is an old religious thing, you know. So in every religion, we see the idea of service. It's called service, but
get us in the golden gates.
Yeah, but I'm not religious. I never was, had it inflicted on me. I'm really lucky that I didn't. My parents were too busy taking drugs to inflict religion on me.
Yeah. But, and for some people, their faith is, you know, very much part of their well-being. But I think you're so right. It costs nothing to make eye contact with somebody. And if I do stop somebody and, you know, I'm giving them coins or cash or getting them something in the shop, I always ask for their name as well.
Yeah.
Everyone deserves to hear their own name.
I know.
And I say, "Hi, Kim. Hi, Beth. Mind yourself."
Same.
And it's so important. And anyone, like, we're not even talking about people in need, but just in the bank queue, just whoever's making your coffee.
Exactly.
Say hello.
Yeah. And the other thing I do a lot of is I often tell women, "You look amazing. I love your outfit." So I was at the Women's Prize garden party the other day and I was standing in the queue. I wore like a 3-piece suit and this woman walked up to me. She said, "You look phenomenal." And I was like, "So do you." And we found each other, total randomers, in the day. We got a photograph together. And I was like, "You made me feel like I shine." She said, "You made me feel that way too." Like, it doesn't even have to be like someone who's struggling. Just say something nice to somebody.
Yeah.
Like, tell them.
And that's important. And we're almost starting to shame that, you know, we shouldn't like to get dressed up and shouldn't like our appearance. And let's spread the love. Well, look, I love you. I think you are an amazing, amazing woman, an amazing writer, an amazing voice.
Thank you.
And you are just a really good person. You're really open and up for coming on this show. And I really, really appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you for having me, Claire.
Hungry is available now. A biography of my body. Katrina O'Sullivan. Keep shining.
Thank you.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aoife Breen, and to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. Rory Galvin was on podcasts. And thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.